Mr. President, it's a great pleasure to be here. My thanks to all of you and to the Board of Trustees of the Society, on which I have served when I was then young. I'm glad to be back in front of you today. In fact, the first Philadelphia Society meeting I ever attended was in New Orleans. It was 1979. I was a second-year graduate student, and Bill Buckley had dispatched me as his guest to the Philadelphia Society's regional meeting. The preceding summer, I had written an appreciation of Harry Jaffa for National Review, which ran as the cover story of its 4th of July edition. Though I'd read all of his books, I had never set eyes on the fellow. Dr. Johnson warned against such literary introductions. Just because you like the eggs, he told Boswell, doesn't mean you want to meet the chicken. But Bill was determined to send me to meet the author upon whom I'd lavished several thousand words, and I was duly summoned to Jaffa's room Friday evening before dinner. I was expecting academic robes, but the great scholar of Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, and Abraham Lincoln opened the door in his t-shirt and boxer shorts, as though to say, "Nobody here but us chickens." I thought for a moment I stumbled into a Marx Brothers movie, but in fact I had opened a long conversation and a long friendship made possible, in part, I'm happy to say, by the Philadelphia Society and Bill Buckley, whose superintending grace helped make the society itself possible. I'm glad to be back with you in New Orleans, and glad to see that the society's dress code has improved. The conservative movement's obituary has been written many times. They've been saying conservatism is about to expire since before it was born. When it came to us, the left was abortionist long before Roe v. Wade. It shouldn't trouble us then to read John Judis, the socialist writer, or Sam Tannenhouse of the New York Times declaring conservatism in extremis once again. Nonetheless, we have to admit that political movements are not immortal. They come into being, generally speaking, to effect some putative reform, and pass out of being when they succeed or fail. Thus, the anti-slavery movement and women's suffrage movement, which succeeded and then closed shop, and the free silver movement and alcohol prohibition movement, which ultimately failed and faded away. Besides such a broad-based but well-defined social and political movements, however, elite intellectual and artistic ones come and go, sporting ideas, large and small, hoping for a vogue. But these two kinds of movements had no intrinsic connection until the late 19th century, when reformism married up with avant-gardism, a new kind of movement emerged. A political movement whose itch to reform could never be satisfied, because the goals of reform were always changing or receding in keeping with the latest intellectual theories or fashions. This was American progressivism, or as it later called itself, liberalism. Barack Obama's instincts spring deeply from the beds of American liberalism. His beliefs are perfectly in keeping with, say, John Dewey's understanding of the end of human life and thus of ethics and politics as growth. Not growth toward anything in particular, toward some mature state or final condition of flourishing, but growth for growth's sake, to see what turns up. Thus the marvelous slogans we heard in 2008, which Dewey would have cheered. Hope. For what? Change. Of what? Since change can be for good or ill, what are we talking about? The slightly stoned non sequitur we heard back, we are the change we've been waiting for. For some reason, they omitted the noun of address, dude. inevitably the chanted refrain, "Yes, we can." Of course, can what? Now, most of these slogans conspicuously lack what are called in grammar subjects and objects. They are meant to be free-floating, childlike, dreamlike, requiring some exterior force, history or the leader, to define them. If we could take all this seriously, the phrases would seem to mean that this generation of Americans can remake themselves and their country as they will. Indeed, one of Obama's favorite words, you'll see it in his books, is self-creation, which he thinks is the essence of America, if it had an essence, which he doesn't think it really has. He promised us transformation, and that's what he's trying to deliver. In this sense, Obama represents nothing new, but rather a rejuvenated, purified, and intensified form of the old liberalism. As I was saying, liberalism was the first political movement in America without a terminus ad quem, the first to offer a future of endless reform, or so-called reform. This future required a constantly evolving, that is to say, growing, social democratic state, to gin up the rights that people need in order to feel authentic, to become the self that they've been waiting for. That hazy goal partakes of the indefiniteness of Karl Marx's account of the perfect communist society, and for the same reason. It's hard to describe what no human being has ever seen, but it's easy to imagine the obstacles waiting for us between here and paradise. That's why no limitation in principle can be applied to the state as it is understood by contemporary liberalism. Of course, it takes time to create and consolidate this new state apparatus, but the liberals have had more than a century and are still merrily working at it. They progress in waves, the new freedom, the new deal, the great society. Bill Clinton even had a slogan early in his administration, which he abandoned for reasons that will be obvious when I pronounce it, the New Covenant. Well, it depends on what you mean by covenanting. Liberalism progresses in waves, as I was saying, and liberals are now hopeful that President Obama is the kind of longed-for prophet leader who can shift politics decisively forward again. He's their 12th imam right now. But they expect there will be a 13th and a 14th. Bill Buckley and conservatism's founders were much closer to and conscious of this liberalism in its radical sweep than we are now, I think. Part of what made that generation heroic was its keen sense of what it was up against. Its awareness, not always fully articulated, of how deeply modern liberalism had broken with the old civilization. Its courage as a generation in facing the possibility that conservatives would be on the losing side of this struggle. Indeed, that heroic generation understood that the political crisis in their day was at its root a crisis within Western civilization. Literate America, Buckley wrote in his publisher statement in the inaugural issue of National Review, in its maturity has turned away from its tradition of fixed postulates, clearly enunciated in the enabling documents of our republic, in favor of radical social experimentation. Buckley traced this renunciation squarely to the progressives, in particular to his favorite relativist, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. This is Buckley. I happen to prefer champagne to dishwater, said the benign old wrecker of the ordered society, Oliver Wendell Holmes, but there is no reason to suppose that the cosmos does. We have come around to Mr. Holmes's view, Buckley continued. So much so that we feel gentlemanly doubts when asserting the superiority of capitalism to socialism, of republicanism to centralism, of champagne to ditchwater, of anything to anything. How curious that one of the doubts one is not permitted is whether at the margin Mr. Holmes was a useful citizen. That's Bill Buckley. How did conservatism handle liberalism's comprehensive challenge to the old civilization? In many respects, nobly. Imperishable volumes by Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, Strauss, and others were written to diagnose our ills and prescribe remedies for them. The Soviet Union's collapse and socialism's profound discrediting around the world redounded as triumphs of the conservative cause. A Republican majority swept into control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years and held control for a dozen more. A major federal welfare entitlement, indeed a New Deal original, was abolished, at least temporarily. Conservatives of one stripe or another have won the presidency 5 out of 8 times since 1980. The federal courts teem with high-quality right-wing judges, though they teem less than we'd like, to be sure. And the movement institutionalized itself in think tanks, magazines, publishing houses, talk radio, and Fox News. And yet, here we are, politically and philosophically on the defensive, as we have not been since the early 1990s, and perhaps not since the 1960s. The worst part is we had it coming. On the political front, we presumed for almost 3 decades that a steady conservative majority existed in the electorate, awaiting activation by the right Republican appeal. This lured our politicians and representatives into thinking their job was easier than it was, by disguising the hard truth that victory depended on persuading, not merely reminding, a crucial segment of the public to think and vote right. This is a center-right nation, we keep hearing. But where is it written it will always be so? In the 1930s and 40s, and again in the 60s and 70s, the center moved left. We may well be poised for another leftward shift. But the idea that conservatives long ago won the battle for public opinion and that the GOP has only to collect on their victory runs afoul of a deeper problem, which is that the definition of conservatism is more clearly up for grabs than at any time since the end of the Cold War. After the fall of the Soviet Union, conservatism lost the urgent motivation provided by anti-communism. Many predicted a crack-up, but what actually happened was a series of flirtations with new, or at least newly assertive, elements of the right. Upward floated the balloons of civil society conservatism. Some of you here are old enough to remember that. It was a kind of anticipation of the compassionate conservatism to come. The balloon of third wave conservatism. This was Newt Gingrich's baby, promising that the microchip and changes in technology would usher in a new decentralized, demassifying age in which the natural political majority would be conservative and governing techniques would be decentralist. That too passed. National greatness conservatism had its day as well, the neoconservative precursor to Bush administration foreign policy. Some traveled farther than others, but each of these balloons descended under the weight of its own limitations and the pressure of events. Libertarianism had its innings too, though fewer than you might have expected. Communism's collapse did not translate directly into capitalism's triumph in Russia and Eastern Europe, and even at home, the welfare state suffered no major indignities. Prosperity made small government less necessary, paradoxically. Onto this disorderly scene strode George W. Bush, touting a compassionate conservatism that accepted the present size of government, or at least resolved to stop arguing about it, and strove to build an enduring Republican majority by increments, appealing to soccer cum security moms, immigrants, and minorities. There was calculation, not just faith, behind the faith-based initiative. Though the strategy contributed to victory in several elections, it came with high costs. literally. Medicare Part D, the new prescription drug entitlement, will cost billions, which used to be real money. More importantly, compassionate conservatism, I think, eviscerated the GOP's reform ambitions. By abandoning even the rhetorical case for limited government, Bush's conservatism left his administration and Congress porcine and spiritless. When Tom DeLay, the heartless conservative Tom DeLay, protested that he could not cut another cent from the federal budget because it was already cut to the bone, you knew things were bad. Compassionate conservatism was, in my view, always a bad idea, whatever its transient tactical advantages. It was President Bush's attempt to leave behind what he called the old stale debates between liberalism and conservatism over the size of government. In 2000, candidate Bush trumpeted three goals for his domestic policy, besides tax cuts: ushering in the, quote, responsibility era, unquote. Yes, that's the same phrase that Obama has borrowed, without attribution. So much for responsibility. So the responsibility era, rallying what Bush called the armies of compassion to help kids after school, and passing the No Child Left Behind Act. Could there be a more depressing list of domestic objectives of a conservative administration? But compassion is a noble calling, Bush said, not an easy virtue. Actually, it's not a virtue at all. It's a passion. A form of passion, as the name suggests. It means feeling with someone else, feeling their pain, usually. Like every other passion, it's neither good nor bad in itself. Everything depends on its object and its fidelity to that object. By itself, compassion is indiscriminate. Its sympathies take no notice of whether suffering is deserved or not. And in practice, our compassion often goes out to whoever is yelping the loudest. That's why the classical political virtue is justice, not compassion. There's a difference between just suffering and unjust suffering. That's why even someone like Abraham Lincoln, who's much of his political career was spent denouncing slavery, but not denouncing it as cruel, per se, not telling stories Uncle Tom's Cabin style of the suffering of slaves, but rather denouncing its injustice, its violation of the rights of man. The indiscriminate or leveling aspect of compassion wore down some of the tough Texas virtues that Bush might have been expected to bring to the presidency. Of course, misplaced compassion isn't the only reason that energy in the executive was lacking in his administration's domestic policy. For example, his record of vetoing legislation was anemic to the extreme, especially compared to his brother's record as governor of Florida, who for a while was known around Tallahassee because of his many exercises of the veto pen. He was known around Tallahassee as Vito Corleone. But George W. Bush's public abandonment of the traditional conservative argument for limited government certainly, I think, sapped the tone of his administration and left the Congress to its pork-happy ways. I don't need to say, I think, anything about Senator McCain's conservatism to this crowd. Suffice it to say that the GOP has nominated has not nominated a thoughtful Reagan-style conservative since, well, Reagan. Every candidate since the Gipper, even those who most identified with him, felt the need to moderate him in some respect, to qualify his conservatism. Bush 41, Bob Dole, Bush 43, John McCain, that's what binds them together as failed or at least flawed Republican politicians. But don't worry, we survived Nixon. We can survive this too. This litany of disappointment might seem to breed despair, but as I say, we should resist. The heroic age of American conservatism, the age of its founding, consolidation, and triumph over communism and socialism, is behind us. The age of Buckley and Reagan is no more, which doesn't mean we still don't have much to learn from them, of course. The era of libertarians and traditionalists joining hands under the aegis of anti-communism is itself past. Yet conservatism is more relevant than ever. Liberalism invests in its political movements a redemptive mission, a never-ending call to build heaven on earth. Conservatism has perforce to embody its own version of that mission, to restore earth to its inhabitants, man to his nature, to his limitations and grandeur, a grandeur inseparable from his permanent limitations. No policy victory can satisfy conservatives because it cannot be permanent. Still, conservatives draw succor from the fact that they don't expect an ultimate vindication in this world. That's our advantage over the liberals. Thus, it is better to say that the first age of heroic conservatism is over. We may and should hope that a second heroic age may soon commence. For it's the hardest questions of all that now confront us. Relativism's deep penetration into elite and popular culture, which is much worse now than it was when WFB was assailing Oliver Wendell Holmes in 1955. And the other great problem, what to do about the liberal state, the protean liberal state. If we are to rise to contemporary liberalism's challenge, to President Obama's challenge, we must rise above the conservatism of the past two decades, and in certain respects, above that of the past half century, to dig deeper the wells that our fathers dug. One of the most interesting aspects of Obama is his determination to contest conservatism's grip on Abraham Lincoln and the American founding, to repossess them for liberalism. He wants to claim, this is why his inaugural speech was full of these references and why his rhetoric in general seeks always to connect himself back to American history through FDR, through even Reagan to some extent, but back to Lincoln and to the founders, which he talks about, which he writes about in his books in a very sustained and interesting way. Obama wants, in short, to claim the title deeds of American patriotism, just as Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s, preparing the way for a new New Deal coalition to govern our politics for the next generation or two. We must meet that challenge. If we were ever prone to think that the Reagan Revolution, that after the Reagan Revolution, American conservatism faced only second or third order issues, we should now be disabused of that comforting illusion. All of conservatism's past victories have only brought us now to the threshold of another epic struggle, a battle for America's soul that will determine whether or not the cause of limited government survives. In the present crisis, conservatives need to fight on many fronts, restoring vigorous growth in a free economy, defending the country against its enemies, and so forth. But the central front will be the fight to prevent big government from metastasizing into socialism. That means healthcare policy, environmental regulation, and economic policy will be crucial in the short run. In the long run, the vital issue for conservatism will be to re-limit government along constitutional lines. The modern administrative state has always operated at the borders of constitutionality, and it often crosses them. Today's administrative agencies combine legislative and executive and often judicial power in the same hands. The very definition of tyranny, as the Federalist Papers put it. But we have now crossed into a wholly new province of unconstitutionality. When the Secretary of the Treasury can be authorized by Congress to spend trillions of dollars on his say-so. In ancient Roman terms, he has been appointed a financial dictator, empowered to do whatever is necessary to save our economic bacon. At least in Rome, a dictatorship was limited to 6 months. Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner's authority knows no such barrier. Meanwhile, the Obama administration has contemplated creating a car czar to run the domestic auto industry, is spending trillions more unaccountably through Federal Reserve actions, and promises further vast exertions of regulatory power over the healthcare, housing, insurance, and banking industries. This is big government on steroids, rapidly eroding the already weakened levies established by the Constitution to contain federal power. Conservatives need to rally quickly before limited government disappears as a practical possibility. As a starting point, we need to insist on no further erosion of constitutional limitations on the federal government. We need to arrest further decline before we can start to move in a healthier constitutional direction. If we can't come to grips with these challenges, conservatives will have little left to defend heroically or otherwise. More importantly, we will have forfeited the chance to save our country. Thank you.